Hey, what's good? This is Rich.
And I'm Marcus.
And you're listening to Paychecks and Balances, where we talk making money, saving money, and getting out of debt, all while having some fun along the way. And on today's show, we're talking to Chris Hutchins, co-founder and CEO of Grove, a financial planning service for young professionals that I've mentioned on a previous episode of the podcast.
And as we also noted the past couple of weeks, our first course, Debt-Free, a four-week starter kit, how I paid off $30,000 in debt, the exact tools I use, and the four-week quick program that y'all have been asking about since I wrote the book. So this is partially to deliver y'all to stop asking, but I know y'all have more questions. I love y'all. We hope to have it available to the people later this month.
And this conversation with Chris is a fun one. We talk about his journey to starting Grove. We talk about personal finance. We talk about some of the misconceptions that people have with financial planning services and a lot more. And without much more delay, here's our chat with Chris, and we hope you enjoy. Welcome to the show, Chris.
Good to be here.
Yeah. So for the folks that are unfamiliar with your background, tell the PMB family a little bit about yourself.
Man, I don't know where to begin. I feel like I'm not a typical career kind of person. Coming out of college, I had no idea what I wanted to do. I went to New York, tried investment banking and management consulting. It was a mess. Decided I loved software and the internet, moved out to San Francisco, tried to find a job, ended up getting laid off in the process, and started a conference called Laid Off Camp to try to get to know people and build a brand for myself. And, you know, that went really well, traveled around the world and came back, was backpacking, trying to, you know, spend as little money as possible, but take advantage of not having a job, and finally found my home working at startups in the Bay Area. So I'd worked at a few different startups, started one, we ended up selling it to Google, spent 4 years at Google, and left to start a company a couple years ago.
Awesome.
My question is, I didn't even know what investment banking was. So for you not to know what you want to do and to jump like into and what potentially could have been an awesome career, and I'm defining awesome as probably high paying, why was investment banking the first step?
It's funny. So I had no idea. I mean, I went to Colorado State, you know, fine school, but certainly not, you know, it wasn't Harvard. And I didn't know that you were supposed to line up a job like a long time before you graduate. So I went home over Thanksgiving my senior year and ran into a friend and he was like, oh, what are you doing for work? And I was like, I don't know. Like, we graduated in May. I've got, you know, 7 months to figure it out. He's like, no, you don't have 7 months. Everyone else already has their jobs. And I asked like, what's a good job? And he's like, the best job you can get is investment banker. And so I went back to school and I went to the dean of the business school and I was like, Ajay, I need a job as an investment banker. What can you do? And he was on a board of a company with another person who ran an investment bank in New York. And he emailed him. He's like, would you interview Chris to be an intern? So when I graduated, my first job after college was actually an internship that turned into a full-time job.
And so you chose the career path just based off of that one recommendation. You didn't question. You were just kind of like, oh, I guess that's what I'm going to do.
I did some research and it was like, well, if you are smart and want to make a lot of money, investment banking or management consulting are really good jobs. And I didn't really know what I wanted to do. And I was like, well, I feel like I'm smart and making a lot of money sounds like a good idea. So yeah, I got this one internship and I'd missed all the hiring for management consulting. And so the only job offer I got started 9 months after I graduated. So I actually, when I went to be an intern at this investment bank, I'd already accepted another job that started 9 months later. So I kind of felt like I had an option value. If I didn't like investment banking 9 months in, I could quit and just take this other job I had lined up.
That's a nice little safety net to have. And what was the other role again that you had waiting for you?
So it was this thing that I also didn't know what it was called, what it was management consulting, which is you go work for a company that, you know, works with Fortune 500 companies and helps them figure out how to do better at their work. You know, we did projects where we'd analyze, you know, pharmaceuticals in the marketplace. We'd analyze, you know, for a cable company, what factors in a, you know, in customers' mindset would change their propensity to bundle all their services and sign up for more things. And yeah, it was an interesting job, but I don't think an entrepreneurial mindset works well in these kind of very structured and regimented workplaces.
And so I've heard a lot of different things about investment banking. I think we probably all have. We know that there's money in it. But what did you find out about the job that you weren't expecting? And I'm guessing it's probably everything.
So the first thing I found out was that when you join an investment bank as a very junior person, like, no one actually cares what you think. They care what you do. And like, the idea of, you know, the thing I love about working at a startup now and this industry is like, we're all in it together. But at an investment bank, someone would say, you know, it's 7 o'clock and they're like, I need this done by tomorrow morning. And my kind of general work principle is like, great, it's going to take 4 hours. If the two of us work on it, we'll get it done in 2 hours. And the investment banking philosophy is, no, actually, I'm going to go home and hang out with my friends. Why don't you work on it for 4 hours?
What?
So regularly, like, every one of my managers would be working, you know, the further down the totem pole you are, the more you work. And there isn't this kind of like teamwork camaraderie aspect as much as like, oh, you're the intern, so get the work done.
So were you actually getting coffee too, or is mainly just doing all the grunt work and then someone else taking credit for it?
Yeah, I was doing all the spreadsheets and the models and the grunt work. You know, the tipping point for me was there was a week went by and the woman who I'm now married to, who at the time was my girlfriend, I don't think I saw her awake for a week. Like, I think every day that week I went home after she'd gone to bed, but I left for work before she woke up. And I was like, this just isn't what I want to do.
Man. And so did you have to do the thing where you actually slept in the office on cots? So actually, is that true that there's like cots for people to sleep in the office?
So I worked at a very small investment bank called Allen & Company. It's like 150 people. It's nothing like Goldman Sachs or anything like that. So we did not have cots in the office, but there were plenty of nights where people were there well past midnight and coming back, you know, before 6 a.m. I lived like 4 blocks from the office intentionally. So, you know, it was just way easier to go home than to sleep in a cot.
And so you decided, all right, this isn't for me. And so did you move on to the consulting gig or did you make a different pivot? Because I know you said you had that waiting for you down the road.
So I took the job at the consulting firm. Everything seemed like, oh, it's a better job. It's more interesting. It's, you know, a little bit, you know, there were a lot more younger people that were all on the same teams. And then I went up to Boston for the weekend at this event that I'd heard of called Startup Weekend. And at the time, there had only ever been one other startup weekend ever. And now there have probably been thousands. And the idea was, let's get a bunch of people who are kind of entrepreneurial minded in a room. And there were designers and there were engineers and there were business people. And let's just come up with a few company ideas and let's build the entire company in the weekend and launch the product or the service before the end of the weekend.
Mm. And so when did you realize you had that entrepreneurial bug to even want to jump into that world? Because I know it's pretty turbulent. Yes, the payoffs can be massive as we see out here in Silicon Valley. But when did you realize that the entrepreneurial world was one that you wanted to be in?
So I think I always knew that starting businesses, like doing random things to make money like that, you know, you could trace that back to childhood. But it wasn't until that weekend in Boston that I realized that like there was actually an industry around it. You know, I was naive. I didn't know that Silicon Valley was even a thing, right? Like I knew that I liked the internet, I liked computers, and, you know, I liked starting small projects and businesses, but I never thought that when I graduated college, like an option was to go to a place and join a small company. Like that just didn't, that wasn't a thing I thought was possible. Mm-hmm. And so this event in Boston, like, was a light switch. I came back, I went straight to my manager and said, hey, what do I need to do to transfer to our San Francisco office? I need to live there.
You made that move. And then I imagine at some point, well, not I imagine, at some point you made a transition. So what did that look like for you?
Oh, so the transition was not my choice. So I moved out here. I remember we moved into our apartment on November 1st because they'd given us the keys and told us, don't go into the apartment until November 1st. And it was Halloween night. So we ended the night, walked in at midnight, and I got laid off like 2 weeks later. So I'd been in the Bay Area 2 weeks with my consulting job. It's November 2008. There's a massive financial crisis. And then I got laid off and had no job. So the transition was made for me.
And so how long were you laid off and what did you do during that time?
Yeah. So when I got laid off, I had no clue what to do, but it was the middle of December. And my assumption was, you know, 2008, Thanksgiving's a couple weeks away, you know, Christmas and the holidays are another couple weeks away. There's no way I'm getting a job. So what do I do? And I started talking to random people that I'd met in the few weeks I'd been out here. And I don't honestly know where the idea totally came from, but I knew there was this kind of tech conference that was called Bar Camp that was like an unconference where you come up with the ideas for sessions at the event. And I just had this idea of, what if we did a laid off camp? Like, so many people are getting laid off right now. What if we did an event for everyone that had been laid off to learn new skills, learn how to start companies, learn how to become a freelancer, learn how to make money on side gigs? And so put on a conference, and we ended up doing one in San Francisco, and I open sourced the whole thing. We had a wiki that anyone could edit, and there ended up being 20 laid off camps around the country, you know, in the 2008, 2009 financial crisis window.
Wow. How long did you run that?
So it was fun. I would say I ran the one in San Francisco, but you know, I every time I wrote a donation letter to an organization, I would publish it on the wiki. And when I made a logo, I published it on the wiki. So people in cities that I'd never even met were going to the laid off camp wiki, taking all the materials that I'd created, the agenda, the topics, the pitches to reporters, and spinning up their own events around the country. And so I know there were ones in Phoenix and Denver and Kansas City, and I just never went to any of them. And, you know, honestly, I didn't have much involvement. I kind of like let it be a thing that lived on its own. And it kept going until the kind of crisis recovered at the end of 2009, and it kind of just disappeared. And I was only super involved with the first one or two of them, trying to help get it off the ground.
This guy's a legend, Marcus.
Yeah, I have a two-part question from that second story. But the first one was, so we got some like entrepreneur-leaning or entrepreneur-esque people. So they're maybe intimidated by the idea. Is there a quick five highlights? Like if I wanted to do this over the weekend and start up a business and launch a product, is that something you can summarize in five? Now you might say it's 500. Part two was, is there somewhere that they could go? Like, is that wiki still available? Or is there somewhere they could visit and get that information?
Yeah. So when it comes to starting a company, the experience at Startup Weekend, which I think is still happening all around the world, was the most valuable eye-opening thing I'd ever done in my whole life, right? I just didn't know that you could start a company. Like, I conceptually knew that you could. I just looked and it looks like there's like, you know, 10 Startup Weekend events in the Bay Area. Like, so they're all over. There's one in Truckee. There's one, you know. So I would say go check out Startup Weekend would be the best place to kind of see how this all kind of unfolds and meet a community of people that will support you through all of that. You know, there's plenty of resources if you look how to start a startup. You know, there's probably a million YouTube channels. Y Combinator, which is a incubator in the Bay Area, runs a startup school online and has all the content open source that you can download and watch. But all you really need is like a passion and an idea and like some ability to make it happen. The tricky part is if you have an idea for an app, but you don't know how to build an app, well, then you either need to have the money to hire someone to build it or investors, and it gets harder. So if you start something where you have the skills to make it, make the first version of it, it becomes much easier.
Thank you.
And so, I mean, for a lot of people, the whole getting investors, that's probably a full episode in itself. And for a lot of folks, the idea of having a startup that's going to turn into some big company is pretty daunting. And they want to start with something that's a little smaller. Maybe it's a home business. Maybe it's a service-based business, which I guess could also be a home business as well. So how would your advice differ for someone who's maybe not looking to create the next tech giant, but maybe a smaller business that's going to provide them income on the side or a transition to a full-time role where they kind of work for themselves?
Yeah. I mean, take, if there's something you're passionate about, maybe it's you want to write a book, maybe you want to start a blog, maybe you want to start a podcast, you know, like all of those things can become businesses. I think when I was looking at, as an investor at companies, the most important thing was that it was something someone's passionate about. I imagine if I asked you guys about the early days of getting this going, like it wasn't as easy.
Nah, it was bad audio. So that's the minimum viable product. It was episodes that ran 2.5 hours, which a lot of folks won't know about because that was on our previous podcast, which I'm not going to drop right now. And yeah, I mean, it really took years for us to get to where we are now. And people often think like, oh, y'all launched this thing. It took off quickly. No. It was like years and weekends and months of struggle to grow this thing to where it is today. So there's definitely a lot of work involved. And I think one of the big things in general is just getting started, you know, instead of trying to focus on, you know, making things perfect.
Yeah, exactly. So get something out there. Someone told me that they really loved cooking and they were like, I don't know, I might want to start a cooking show on YouTube. And I was like, they were like, oh, it'd be fun to just like me and my daughter who's like you know, 2.5. Like, she likes to stand on the counter and we cook together. And I was like, just record some episodes, you know, put it on YouTube. I promise that, like, the hardest thing will just be getting them out. So just, like, commit to 10. You won't get any traction. It won't be exciting. It takes time, but, like, anyone could do that. So, you know, the hardest part is just getting it out there and committing to it. But it goes back to, you have to really care, because if you guys didn't care about talking about money, for example, right, like, it would have been impossible to get through that the early days.
Right, right. Yeah, and there were a lot of things, even in terms of how we approached it early on, where we knew that we wanted to focus on personal finance and career advice, but we felt like we had to throw other things in there to keep people's interest, given that we came from a completely different niche altogether. So how do you feel about the importance of market research and targeting this specifically to the maybe the person who's not thinking about creating some company that's going to turn into a big giant, but maybe someone who wants to start something a little smaller? So kind of like you said, a blog, a YouTube. What do you think the importance of market research is in that?
It's funny. Whenever I thought about whether someone should go start the thing they were starting, I would say, are you passionate about it? Is there an opportunity there? And can you do it? And that applies to really big companies, and that applies to small projects, and that applies to, you know, home businesses. And so one, you know, I said, you got to be really excited about it, because starting a company of any size is really, really hard. Two, you know, you want to make sure that you can put that minimum product together, whether that's a podcast or a book or, you know, a side business. And then the third one is, like, is there actually a business here? So, you know, I might think it's really cool to take pictures of my dog wearing costumes, and maybe there actually is a business, you know, making an app that just lets you make an app that takes pictures of dogs and adds costumes. But, like, make sure that there's actually enough people there. And so that market research could be more lightweight, it could be heavier, but I'd want to make sure that if I were, you know, trying to create an ebook of, you know, Thai restaurant or Thai recipes, you know, maybe I'd want to get a sense of, are there a lot of Thai restaurants? Okay, well, there are. So people must like Thai food. So, you know, do people cook? Yeah, people cook. So maybe there's enough of a market there. But, you know, maybe if the answer is I want to make a recipe book for how to cook with insects, you might be like, well, maybe there's not enough people, but that's going to be a really big business, you know?
I know a lot of people, when they're getting started with whatever their thing is, they tend to go to family and friends for feedback first, and they'll consider that their market research. And so I've found that oftentimes in those situations, when people do that, they're going to the wrong people, and that's not their ideal customer for whatever it is that they're trying to do. So do you have any thoughts on that? When someone's getting started, like, who should they be going to get that actual feedback on what they've built or what they're creating?
Yeah, random people that aren't afraid to give you really, really harsh feedback. You know, if you go set up a booth at the, you know, go stand in a mall and run into people and ask them questions, or go pay for a SurveyMonkey survey where you can get random people in the demographic you're looking for. You know, I started this most recent company. We tried to make sure our first 20 customers were people we didn't know, because I wanted to know if people liked it. And if my friends signed up, it's very unlikely that they would say, oh, I signed up and it's horrible, I hate it, you're a terrible entrepreneur, you should leave this and stop doing this. We're too supportive of our friends and family, which is a good thing. But when you're starting a company, it's really easy to get too much bias towards everything you're doing is right. And what you really need is harsh feedback about how to improve or change, or maybe what you're doing is not a good fit. And the sooner you can find that out, the less you've invested in it, and the harder it'll be to, you know, change the direction or even stop doing it.
Super helpful. You mentioned you'd gotten laid off in 2008. You had time to get this other project off the ground that turned into this thing that went across the country. So I'm imagining you had some money saved probably from your time working at the management consulting gig at this point. So what was your approach to saving so that, well, I mean, I guess you didn't know that the 2008 crisis was going to happen, but it sounds like you had some runway. So what was the process for you and the thoughts in terms of how you went about saving so that you could have some time to do these other things?
Yeah, so I had a few fortunate things. So one, my now wife, then girlfriend, who I lived with, had a job. So that really helped. Two, you know, I'd always been a really, like, frugal, thrifty kind of person my whole life. You know, I went to a school where, you know, some kids would be like, oh, let's go out to, it was a boarding school. And some kids would take a taxi. And I was like, no, I'm going to take the bus. You know, like, I was always trying to find, like, the cheaper, more affordable way to do everything. In my dorm room, I had like a little oven, like a toaster oven, so we could cook. You know, like I was just always trying to spend not a lot of money. And so the good thing about investment banking and management consulting is that you work so many hours that you don't have any time to spend your money. You know, I was barely even able to go home and see my wife awake. So I was, you know, eating breakfast, lunch, and dinner at the office. I was fortunate that I had saved. When we decided at one point about a year after laid off camp in 2009, my wife didn't like her job. I didn't have a job and was doing some freelance work. And we kind of looked at our bank account and I think we had somewhere around like $20,000, $25,000, I think, saved. And we said, you know, let's go on a trip before we get back into work because we both want to work really, really hard. And I don't know if this was the best financial move at the time, but looking back, you know, I'm glad we did it. But we actually decided to just pack everything up, put it in storage and buy two backpacks and buy a one-way ticket to South Africa and like go on a trip and, you know, just see where it takes us before we ran out of money.
Well, when you were opening that story, I thought you were going to say a number that had three less zeros in it because that would have been my account. And we looked and we said, what are we going to do with this $25? And then we probably went to the movie theater. So actually, I realized we've been talking this whole time and I guess I should drop this conversation because I had to Google it. So people who don't know what investment banker is, according to Investopedia, great source, by the way, is an individual who often works as part of a financial institution, primarily concerned with raising capital for corporations, government, or entities. So for those of you who are, hopefully you're raising your eyebrows in appreciation there. But my question was going to be, in addition to that story, maybe even like whatever, you know, did you go to a hill and the sun rose and you had your awakening moment? And or as an investment banker, did you see something in the numbers or financials or how large corporations, apparently governments or entities manage their money that taught you something about how to manage money, period?
Man, I wish there was a moment or a hill or anything. I think if anything, the investment banking community and like the way I would describe the job slightly different from Investopedia is investment bankers usually get hired by companies who are trying to buy other companies or get sold or raise capital. And so you're always constantly trying to figure out, is this a good deal or how do we find people for the deal? And so usually on one side of each of those conversations is someone that makes a lot of money. And the investment bankers are usually the ones that make a lot of money and not the interns, unfortunately, but so I was surrounded by people that were making lots of money. And it seemed like the things people were doing with that money was just like not that exciting, you know, going on lavish trips or like renting fancy hotel rooms in New York City where they had their apartments to throw parties.
That sounds exciting to me.
If I may interject.
Yeah. I think for some reason at the time I was like, I'm doing all this work. The last thing I want to do is, you know, go out and party. I want to go and like say hi to my wife who I haven't seen for 5 days. So it made me be like, what do I want to spend my money on? What's important to me? Cause a lot of the other stuff wasn't important to me. So if anything, being surrounded by people that make a lot more money than you, watching how they spend that money made me spend less money.
I'm glad you said that because I was also thinking about what your experience was with money growing up, because a lot of us, we get to high school, college, we get that first job and our instinct is to spend, probably do what you saw a lot of the folks around you doing. And you even mentioned being in boarding school and people are taking taxis because there was no Uber at the time and you chose to take a bus. So where does that financial foundation come from?
Yeah. So I've tried to, you know, in the last few years, figure out like, what's the real root of all of this? Like, where did it all come from? My grandparents were like the thriftiest people you could imagine. You know, they were the ones that, you know, had a timeshare in Mexico and filled their suitcases with food that we would cook there because they didn't want to spend money going out to eat. And, you know, going out to eat in Mexico is actually pretty cheap. And so they were, you know, an inspiration. They loved to travel. And so they started a travel agency to take people that they'd met in, you know, their community on trips so that they could go along, tag along for free. You know, there's kind of random anecdotes like that throughout my life. But I think what happened was I grew up fortunate that, you know, my parents were able to send me to boarding school, which, you know, I think a lot of people think is like the worst thing ever. I actually enjoyed it. But, I didn't have a lot of the people that I went to school with had a lot more money than I did. And you know, their parents gave them a lot of that money. And so in high school, I was like trying to get the school to let kids at school do more jobs. I was like, can I work at the post office to make more money? And so I think it's kind of a theme of watching people that have money, that parents give them more of it, that they can spend it lavishly, just trying to figure out like, well, I don't want to do that. That seems so irresponsible. And it just kind of led me down this, how do I save? How do I optimize? How do I, you know, do everything? So by college, I was, you know, trying to earn frequent flyer miles on credit cards and like playing that game because I just wanted to be able to do more, but I didn't want to spend the money to do it.
What's good, folks? We're taking a quick break from our chat with Chris to tell you about today's sponsor. Backblaze, not to be confused with Backshots, is a gimmick-free unlimited cloud backup service for Macs and PCs. It'll back up everything, including music, photos, videos, documents, projects, and whatever else you're afraid of losing. You can access all your data from anywhere, from the web or the app, which means you've got options. As someone with an increasingly janky laptop with a crazy amount of podcast content, I can't tell you how important it is to back up your stuff and easily be able to access it. Backblaze makes it simple. If you're interested in never losing a file again, visit backblaze.com/paychecks for a no-risk free 15-day trial. Play around with it and see how easy it is to restore your files. Again, that's backblaze.com/paychecks. And now, back to the show.
Some people I know, possibly present company, I'm still working through my thoughts here, are going to hear this story and they think it's crazy. Like, more money doesn't equal happiness. That's insane, because it's something that they're pursuing. And it's, you know, I've been on both sides. So I'm not rich now, but I've been very broke. And I've stopped calling myself poor because I feel like that's a different echelon that fortunately I was not in. So I feel like broke is a state of mind. Poor is you can't even afford what you need. Broke is when you get and you can't afford what you want. So I stopped kind of, that's my little delineation between poor and broke. But for those folks who want a little bit more information, this article just came out and I thought it was a good write-up, but of course it went sideways because everyone online is angry. And it's Rich and Miserable. It's on New York Times. I'll get that in the show notes. But what he was studying, he went to an Ivy League school and a lot of people went into, ironically, of course, investment banking. And he talked about that. So he went back for like his 10-year anniversary. And so many of his peers were rich and miserable. And he wrote a story about it, which I thought was going to be bad, but is actually, I thought, really balanced. And he says here, the upper echelon is hoarding more money and privilege to a degree not seen in decades, but that doesn't make them happy. And for those who aren't going to read it, basically it ends with because they weren't pursuing their passion. So when he graduated and everyone went off to investment banking, obviously he went into journalism and everyone thought he was crazy. And he just talked about all the happiness that he's found through journalism. And now he's, you know, well paid for the field that he is in because he's a senior journalist. And he did like a profile on this guy who's a millionaire who was essentially miserable. And I think he has some quote in there who's like, after so many zeros in your account, it's just like watching commas move. So I think that's a really good read. And to kind of give some balance to that, I think people might also want to look in that. Did you find that to be, it sounds like you did, true as well, like that passion for you was more important than income?
Absolutely. My book that I love is Happy Money, which kind of just tries to break down the things you can spend money on that actually make you happy versus the things that don't. And I've totally found it true. It just doesn't, you know, I'm living in Silicon Valley, like there are people that you'll always be surrounded with more money than you. And I've been to these dinners where people are like, yeah, let's get the really nice wine. And I'm like, I don't understand. Like, I'm the person that's really annoying. That's like, hey guys, like I'm going to buy out of trying to split the bill because I really don't need the fancy wine. I really like, I just, it doesn't make me any happier. Like, I enjoy being around you people, but like whether I have a you know, $5 glass of wine or a $100 glass of wine, like doesn't make a difference. Like it doesn't, it's crazy.
Cool. And so you worked in the finance space and of course you had this financial foundation from your grandparents and probably other family members traveling with food in suitcases. That's interesting. I'm not going to ask about that, but what led you to become interested in the personal finance space? And then after that, we'll talk a little bit about your company.
Yeah. So I think it's just been this kind of constant search for optimization paired with, you know, I tried a lot of jobs. You know, I tried investment banking. I didn't love it. I tried management consulting. I didn't love it. as I kept trying these jobs and not loving them, I became like somewhat scared that I would never find a job I loved. And I think that drove my, you know, savings habits so fast, because I was like, if I'm never going to find a job I love, like I need to save as much money as possible as fast as possible, because there's no way I'm going to spend the next 40 years of my life working, doing something I don't love. So that drove me to down this path of like, what's the cheapest way to do everything? How do you save money? How do you invest that money? How do you, you know, use credit card points? How do you, like, every possible personal finance tactic? I think I have an optimizing kind of mindset from the way I run a company, from the way I work, everything. So that just, if you have an optimizing mindset and you need to figure out how to save as much money as possible, like, you go deep on personal finance.
Mm. So Incomes Growth, tell us about it.
Yeah. So I've basically looked around at all of my peers over the last few years, and everybody's comes up to me. They're like, I have no idea what I'm doing with my money. It seems to be a very consistent theme that there are very few people that seem to feel like everything they're doing financially is on the right path. And so I told them, I was like, oh, you should do what I did. I went to build a cash flow model for myself. And, you know, I started saving every dollar I could. And, you know, I figured out what I needed and you know, ran some simulations on how investment performance would work. And you should do that. And everyone looked at me like I was the craziest person in the world. And I said, okay, so you're not going to do that. So you should go get a financial advisor, and maybe they can help you figure out what to do. I didn't know anything about the financial advising space at the time. And I thought I was making a really sane recommendation. And a few people came back to me and said, I looked into financial advisors. It doesn't seem like a thing I should get. So I did some homework. It turns out that 9 out of 10 financial advisors do not have a sole fiduciary obligation to act in your best interest at all times, which kind of blew my mind. You know, if you think about, if you relate it to doctors, like imagine if 9 out of 10 doctors could just tell you something that actually wouldn't make you healthier or wouldn't make you as healthy as something else. And so I was like, man, I just told my friends to go get financial advisors. And it seems like financial advisors are pretty bad. Lots of them are selling annuities and mutual funds and life insurance and not there. You know, there might be good versions of all of those products, and those are not the ones financial advisors are selling. So I thought, well, what do people do? And, you know, who are the 1 in 10 financial advisors that truly care about their clients and act in their best interests? And it, almost every single one of them only worked with people that had $1 million. Mm. So, you know, most of my friends don't have $1 million. So I couldn't refer them to, you know, these wealth managers. And so I kept digging, and I found that there's this niche of financial planners, certified financial planners that, you know, have either a hourly model or an annual model or a one-time model of kind of building out financial plans. And it was different from managing your investment portfolio. It was all about understanding what you cared about in life, what your priorities were, and helping you align all of your financial decisions with your money with what you actually care about in life, whether that's buying a home or raising a family or being able to retire early or start a side business. So I was like, man, everyone needs a financial planner. Like, I'm going to go find all these friends of mine and tell them to go get a financial planner. And the cost was, I would say, both high, but also in the relative to the impact it could have seemed reasonable. But the, you know, the average cost was about $2,500, which is not, you know, something that most of my friends were ready to spend. So I was like, man, I keep thinking I found a solution for my friends, and I hadn't. And I was like, why does it have to be so expensive? And so I went and I met with financial planners, and the way they learn about you is they're like, hey, could you print out all your bank statements and bring them to the office? And, you know, I'll go through them. And I was like, okay, well, that seems really inefficient. Like, why can't we do this online? And, you know, the way they organize information is in like an Excel spreadsheet, and they type it into this really old software that spits out 100-page document. And then they walk through the document after they put it in a binder. And then like 6 months later, it's totally out of date. Like I think it's totally ridiculous. And so having worked in Silicon Valley, I was like, oh, like, why don't we just build software that lets the client share their information and sync their bank accounts? And then that saves the advisor time. Let's build like a beautiful way to explain what you need to do with your financial situation online so people can comprehend it, which is way better than like a 100-page document. And because everything's synced and because it's online, we can evolve it over time and not need to redo everything from scratch. And so had that vision, decided to talk to a few investors, raise a little capital, hire a team, build the software, hire the advisors. And we've been kind of on this mission for the last two and a half years to make financial planning more honest, more affordable, more accessible, and something that people can get access to earlier in their lives, earlier in their careers, and hopefully end up in better positions, you know, in their life earlier.
And I'm sure Rich is going to have some follow-up questions here, but I am going to drop two plugs. I open up with that disclaimer. I apologize. But at paychecksandbalances.com/books, we looked at 15 personal finance books, but one of those is Dollar and Cents. And what I found fascinating, a quote from there, is actually they had a couple, but one was that 4 in 10 financial planners didn't have a financial plan themselves. So they surveyed financial planners and they don't plan financially. And then I think the other statistic, and I should have gotten it in front of me, but 30% of Americans are so far behind in saving for retirement, they will have to work until they're 80. The average life expectancy is 78. So we got some work to do. And the other plug was we actually did an Ask a Certified Financial Planner series. So I'll get that in the show notes for people too. I agree with all the advice that you gave. It was a great series.
It's so interesting when people are a specialist or an expert in the field, but then when it comes to their own stuff, they don't have it all together. And
well, it's like seeing doctors outside a hospital smoking.
I was just going to say that.
As you walk in.
I was going to say, we're going to the gym and you know what? I'm not going to go down that rabbit hole. I was going to talk about personal trainers and having a person. So actually I will go down that rabbit hole real briefly.
Let me stop you, brother. Don't talk about anybody who could beat you up. We got to do the show next week.
So this person would have to catch me and I don't think they would. And it actually ends with, I went into this spin class and the instructor looked pretty out of shape, but I was surprised. I was shocked. This person blew through this class. I'm panting. I'm struggling. So sometimes looks can be deceiving, man. That's all I was going to say. I was going to end it on a high note there.
All right. Well, good save.
And so, Chris, I imagine, you know, you're getting the company off the ground. You're talking to folks about it. They hear financial advisor. They hear financial planning. What are some of the most common misconceptions that you might have heard from folks when it comes to financial advisory services?
Yeah, I mean, the most common one is that financial advisors are only for rich people. You know, we talk to people, we're like, oh, you know, we have this financial planning company. They're like, oh, sorry, I don't have $1 million yet. So it's like, it's obviously not for me, which is somewhat historically true, right? Like historically, to get a good financial advisor who would act in your best interest, you pretty much needed to have $1 million. So that's one thing. You know, the idea that a financial advisor can't help with your specific situation. Someone's like, well, I'm just so different than, you know, everyone's different. Everyone has a different, you know, set of priorities and that kind of stuff. And that's why I think the value of human financial planning comes in, is that there's another person on the other end of a phone or in person to help think through those things. But the main one was people just don't do it. People think, you know, I don't need to plan for my future, despite, you know, you listed some stats. You know, I think mine favorite is like 81% of people don't even know how much they need to retire. And a third of people in America have no retirement savings. So somehow there's this disconnect where everyone seems to know that money's a problem. It's the number one cause of stress, the number one cause of divorce. Yet most people don't feel like that problem is acute enough that they need to do anything about it today.
Sorry, I was stomped there by some of those numbers, but I do agree are accurate. And I guess actually that's a good segue, because my question was going to be, you know, some people are going to hear 2,500. I think Rich talked about 500 on a previous episode for a financial planner that he consulted with. How do you convince somebody that it's worth it?
So it's hard, right? You know, they're certainly not, you know, there are a lot of regulations in place to prevent financial planners from, or financial advisors from, you know, using anecdotes about, oh, you know, with this client, we've saved this much money, you know, for good reason. So trying to quantify the value of financial advice is quite difficult, you know, because it's both regulatorily difficult, but also it's just hard because everyone's different. Vanguard did a pretty thorough study that I'll reference. They kind of found that the average, they called it the advisor alpha. You know, they said, and I'm quoting them, they said, we believe, you know, implementing the Vanguard advisor alpha framework can add about 3% in returns to your clients. So their belief is that it was somewhere around 3%. But they broke it down into all these things. The interesting thing is, of the 3%, 1.5% of it was behavioral coaching. So, you know, half of the return they think an advisor can get is all the things like, you know, cost effective portfolios and rebalancing and a spending strategy and that. But the other half is just behavioral coaching and helping people figure out what they specifically need to do for their circumstance, helping them think through decisions and making the right ones. And Vanguard would say that, you know, the return is based on a percentage. The challenge is, if you don't have an investment portfolio right now, thinking about it in terms of percentage return is really hard. So, you know, you could also think about it in terms of, you know, just emotional feeling, like how much is it worth to not stress about money anymore? How much is it worth to, you know, feel like you have a little bit more control, a little bit more empowerment, a little more peace of mind?
And I appreciate you saying that. And I'm glad that they actually brought that out. I think it's a little bit funny, but I'd take a whole nother show to go into all the details. So I'm going to quote James Clear, and I'm going to turn it back over to you. He's the author of Atomic Habits. He probably thinks I'm stalking him because I've quoted him like 2 or 3 times on the gram recently. So he's probably a little bit worried about that. But he said recently, everyone already knows this is very different from everyone already does this. You don't need more ideas. You need more action. So I hope to the people listening here from these takeaways that just because you know it, if you are not practicing it, you have a disconnect. So I'm hoping that you either move forward, either finding the person that can do it for you, which I think is what you're advocating for the financial planner, or honestly, you can do it yourself, but most people aren't doing themselves. We've had this strange conversation about Digit as well. So you know, just be honest with yourself here, folks. And I hope this episode would be helpful for you to at least take action, which is more important than just thinking about it.
Yeah. We had this fun exercise of writing obituaries for the company. And so, you know, when we wrote it, we were like, look, if the world ends up that people learn this kind of financial planning knowledge in school or on their own and start to take control of their money themselves and make all the right decisions on their own, like we were all like, we will be totally happy shutting the door of the company, right? Like if that happens, that would be amazing. But until it does, people aren't all going to do everything on their own. So we have to play our part to try to help.
Hashtag like.
And so we're rounding toward the end of the show here. And so I'm sure your clients have provided a lot of feedback to the various advisors. I think I'm using the correct term there. So what have you guys found that people are struggling with the most when getting started?
Yeah, I think one of the hardest things is just trying to get a sense of where they're at. And so everyone is stressed out because they don't, you know, they're out of control. And so the question is, sometimes we've found clients where they're actually in a much better situation than they thought, and just not knowing that was stressful. And it turns out some of them are saving enough and they just didn't know it. So they're stressed out about something that they didn't need to be stressed out about. So that's one thing that's interesting we found. Another was just trying to really think through priorities and not understanding the impact actions today with your money have in the future. So we've had clients that would be able to tell you the most important thing to them is to save for their kids' future. That's like all that matters to the world to them. But because they have no idea, let's take their kids' college savings. They have no idea how much that's going to cost and what they'd need to save for it. So it just feels like really hard to make a tangible decision today. But if you break down, well, based on how you're saving right now and all the money you have, you know, if you could add another $200 a month towards your kid's education, you'll actually be on track to pay for it. And then all of a sudden they're like, oh my gosh, now I can trade off going out to dinner a few times with, you know, saving this $200 because I actually can connect the goals to the actions today. And I think because people don't know how to connect, you know, what their actions today will have effects down the road on their goals and run through the like effective cash flow planning and modeling of their future, they end up making poor decisions today that would be much easier to make if they understood how to connect money with goals.
I'm so glad you said that, because in a conversation I had where, you know, I laid out my picture and I was receiving feedback, it became very clear that what I needed for my walkaway fund, and I've talked about in the podcast before that at some point I want to be able to pursue entrepreneurship full time, that the way that I was thinking about it, I realized that I would have to do so much more to be able to get that amount saved to make that leap, or I'd have to start finding ways to cut so that I could tuck that money away to be in the position to have that runway to make a move. And I'm someone who's decent with my money, and I've done well to get out of debt and, you know, become 100% debt free and to start stocking money away in savings. But there were certain things that I just didn't know. And I think it's, you don't know what you don't know, which is, you know, why there is value in taking advantage of some of these fee only services that are out there.
Yeah. I mean, to quote G.I. Joe, knowing is half the battle.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's pretty straightforward in that regard. But Chris, it's been fantastic having you on the podcast. I hope everyone got a lot out of this conversation. So tell the people where they can find you and where they can learn more about Grove.
You can find us on the internet at hellogrove.com. But if you go to hellogrove.com/paychecks, we'll have a special offer for you guys if you listen and sign up. If you want to find me, I'm chrishutchins.com or at Hutchins on Twitter.
Awesome, man. So appreciate you extending that special offer to the Paychecks and Balances audience. And yeah, a lot of insight on this show. And yeah, we appreciate you.
Yeah, of course. Thanks for having me.
That was a fun one, man. And thanks again to Chris for coming on the show and also for the discount for the audience. We didn't even know he was going to do that.
Yes, sir. So y'all know, jump on those new goods. And I mean, this one had me, I almost feel like I want to go full Steve Jobs over here with the startup weekend and building the company. I don't know what I want to build and what I want to do, but I am intrigued. I will be getting my Google search on from this one.
Yeah, definitely a lot of good nuggets. We hope people got a lot out of the episode. And if you enjoyed today's episode, be sure to share with your network and hit us with those 5 stars in Apple Podcasts and say a few words about the show. Now, we've seen an uptick in reviews over the past few weeks, so definitely appreciate that. And we're going to keep it going today.
This one comes from, oh man, I'm at the stop.
Monier Mitchell. That's how you say it.
This one.
We tried.
I got there and I stumbled. I stumbled in panic, honestly. I was at the free throw line. 40-somethings are in the house too! 5 stars. Hey guys, love your podcast. Recently you mentioned most of your audience being 20 and 30-somethings. Just want you to know 40-somethings, I'm 45 to be exact, are loving your great information too. Can you give a shout out to the 40 and over crew from me? Yes, I can. Shout out to the 40-somethings. I actually had somebody stop me outside and I literally think their uncle's name was Charles. And so shout out to Uncle Charles who also listened to the show. Thank you, Monier, for your listening to the show, the 5 stars, and you end with thanks for your hard work and sacrifice, and we thank you for listening.
Yes, definitely shout out to the 40-somethings and beyond. I've also seen, I think we've had people who are over 50 listening to the podcast too, which is always kind of crazy to me.
I don't want to start a competition here because now the 50-somethings are going to start writing in, which is going to lead to the 60-somethings. And, you know, I'm tired of all this generational divide. We here at Paychecks and Balances are bringing everybody together. We appreciate y'all for listening to the show. Millennials, stop killing every industry that exists.
So Monier, really do appreciate those 5 stars.
And if you'd like to find us on social, we're on Twitter and Instagram at PayBalances and Facebook at Paychecks and Balances. Follow our individual accounts. You can find me at the Marcus Garrett with 1 T on Twitter, 2 T's everywhere else on earth, like the government name. Rich is available all over the web at I Am Rich Jones.
I am.
As we mentioned up top, don't forget to join our email list by visiting paybal.co/email. Receive our weekly newsletter covering interesting reads, actionable tips, and exclusive content, as well as the launch date for the upcoming course.
So we want to thank everybody so much for listening. And until next time, be safe. We out. Peace.